So as I mentioned last week, this is the second part of this two-part series called The Five Factors of Concentration. And I want to start by actually reading a little something from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. I actually got two or three things I'm going to read from this thing tonight. This is in a section called Establishing Concentration Takes Time. One of the great gifts of deepening concentration is that it helps keep the various mental hindrances at bay. It is like building a fence to keep out unwanted intruders. By temporarily dampening the force of lust and craving, aversion and restlessness, it opens us to more refined pleasures of the mind. This in turn gives us impetus to develop concentration even more. Over time, we see the default level of concentration increase in our own minds, which changes how we feel and how we are in the world. We create an inner environment of peace. Although concentration is not the final goal of the practice, still it plays an essential role on the path of awakening. The Buddha emphasized this when he said that respect for concentration is one of the things that leads to the longevity of the Dhamma, to its non-decay, and non-disappearance. This is an important statement for the transmission of the Dhamma to the West. We would like everything to be instant, even enlightenment. And we often don't want to put in the time or effort to develop and deepen our concentration. But as samadhi gets stronger in our daily lives, it helps us find that place where we increasingly abide free of desires and discontent in regard to the world. And this peaceful composure becomes the basis for greater happiness and freedom. I like this for two reasons. One is that it makes it clear that this isn't instant. Right? This is something we have to work at. And the other thing I like about it is that he makes it really clear that this is where a lot of the sweetness of the practice comes from the concentration. So it's sort of, it's hard, but boy, it's kind of nice. That's sort of what he was saying. And I think that's a very fair statement. So before I go on to the last three factors of concentration, I want to very briefly review what I talked about last week, just for people who weren't here last week, and also just to sort of make this a complete talk. So the first two of the factors of concentration were vitakka and vichara, which roughly are translated as aiming and sustaining. So aiming was that idea that we sort of consciously set the intention to do something. We're aiming at something. And that could be as simple as aiming at seeing the very beginning of a breath, to aiming to sit for half an hour. These are both aiming, the micro level and the macro level. But and then sustaining is this idea that then we stick with it. Not only are we aiming to do something, now we're going to stick with it. And that might be, you know, once again, on the micro level, we aim to see the very beginning of a breath, then we sustain on that breath. We really stay with that breath. So we start to feel all the subtle little things that happen just in an inhale. And if you start to pay attention, it's quite astounding how much goes on just in an inhale or an exhale. And similarly, sustaining might mean really not sort of, okay, I'm going to sit here for half an hour, and then about 5 minutes in, you're going, oh, I'm not comfortable today. I'm not doing well. I think I'm going to go watch Star Trek or whatever it is that you get distracted by in your life. You know, it's like really having the intention and then sticking with it on that larger level, or even on the level of I'm going to practice every day and sustaining that. That's, you know, we aim to practice every day, and then we sustain by actually practicing every day. So it has all these two have layers. I want to talk more about the micro level tonight, about the actual experiences that arise as you start to get a rhythm going with aiming and sustaining in your seating practice, or in your walking practice for that matter. So these first two, aiming and sustaining, lead quite directly to the third of these mental factors called pitti. And pitti is often translated, unfortunately, as from my point of view, as the word rapture. And it's just, the rapture has that whole sort of loosey-goosey hallelujah vibe to it that I feel uncomfortable with. Though, to be honest with you, at this point, the practice can be quite rapturous. I mean, I'm not denying that, but it's sort of incomplete, that translation. I think a better translation is something like zestful interest. It's like you're aiming, you're sustaining, things are just going along, you're staying in the moment, you're seeing things arise and go away, and you're starting to go, wow, is this ever cool? This is so interesting. It's like you're just fascinated by what's actually arising. Even though it's just like a breath, your breath might become totally fascinating for a while, or whatever is arising might become, it's like we're just amazed, you know, intense interest, enjoyment of the practice. This is a really important stage in the practice because it encourages us to keep practicing. Now this isn't like, oh God, here I am, another breath, oh boy. It's like, wow. It's like it sort of makes the practice kind of exciting. And sort of we're like, oh boy, I can't wait till I get to sit again and go there. Which we have to be very careful with that thought. Because, you know, next time you sit there, it's going to be the train wreck day, and it ain't going to happen at all. You're lucky if you can aim anything, let alone sustain it, right? And that's just the nature of practice, too. But when it does, these things do happen, it's like, it's really, it encourages you. Often at this stage in concentration, as you get deeper into concentration, there are often very distinct physical characteristics that arise. I'll give you a couple of personal examples, and from my understanding, these are fairly common. One is that you start to feel very heavy. All of a sudden, it's like, now you feel like a rock. Like you feel like you're just sort of, whatever you're sitting on, you're now just connected to the earth through that thing you're sitting on. Like you're just so solid. It's a very distinct physical sensation of solidity, of heaviness. Not in an unpleasant way. It's just like, wow, I really feel like you feel really totally connected to the earth and grounded. And part of that is a sense of like the body is actually heavier. So that's one thing that happens. The flip side of this is you start to feel sometimes quite light, almost as if you're floating. And this has to do with we're starting to to pay less attention to concepts of what's happening and more to just the pure sensation. For instance, you're sitting and your hands are resting on your thighs, perhaps, or resting in your lap. For me, this is very predominant when I'm hands resting on my thighs sometimes. And really, hand and thigh are just concepts. They're not really anything to do with what's actually happening. What's actually happening, what you're actually feeling, is the sensation of the contact between those two areas of body. Hand resting on thigh has a certain set of sensations that arise. And when you start to feel, hey, just experience the sensations without any sense of like hand and thigh, it's like your hands are floating above your thighs sometimes, or your hands disappear, which is really interesting. Like all of a sudden you don't have any hands anymore. It's like there's just like nothing there. There's just sensation. There's no sense of hand anymore. Same thing with your feet on the floor if you're sitting on a chair, where your feet start to feel like they're floating right off the floor. Really, nothing's happening. They're not really floating. It's just now you're really tuned into the sensation of this thing called foot resting on this thing called floor, which are just concepts. Really, all that's happening is this sensation arising at that point of contact through what's going on in the nerves in our feet and legs. So it's a lightness. Both of these, both heaviness and lightness, can be quite pleasant. You know, this is like that's where the rapture stuff comes from. In a sense, that's where that translation comes from, because it can be like, oh, this is kind of so sweet. Like you just want to hang out there. And part of it comes from being very still. This is where stillness really starts to manifest. The energy of stillness manifests in these ways, in this more concentrated, pithy-like energy. But, and there's always a but, right? No, two. Actually, there's two buts. One is that some of the things that might happen can actually be quite unpleasant and even scary. The most common one, again, is your body starts to shake, or it feels like it's shaking. Like this very powerful vibration happening, and literally you start, you know, swaying back and forth and moving around. It's just like energy is manifesting in this quite powerful way. And it can seem like you're just like losing control of your body, which can be quite scary. But this is just a manifestation of concentrated energy getting more concentrated. If you have background in the yoga world at all, and you might have heard of the phrase Kundalini or Kundalini Shakti, that's what this is, only we don't call it that in this world. But it's like it's that energy of vibrational energy. You can get quite strong, tense sensations in the groin area for the same reason, where it's like you feel things are getting really tight down there is the only way I can describe it. And it's just like, once again, kind of scary, like, gee, what's going on, you know? But these are all very sort of normal things. These are all physical manifestations of pithi, this concentrated energy starting to manifest in the physical body. And I also want to say, none of those things might happen at all. It's like don't feel like, oh, well, I'm not having any physical sensations, I guess I'm not doing this right. Another thing, another sensation I've had in this sort of way is just the sense that my breath is like almost disappeared. Like there's almost no sensation at all. Like even the sensation of breath is like, yeah, I sort of think there's a breath there, but it's like you don't, it's like it's so subtle that there's not even the motion of breath anymore. It's that pithy energy in this very soft, still, gentle way. All manifestations of the same concentrated process. So that's problem number one, all these different physical sensations. Problem number two is this becomes, if especially with the more pleasant ones, this becomes very attractive. Like, oh, I want to just go back there again today and the tomorrow and the next day too. It's like this is, you become addicted to the pleasantness and you start practicing just to have these pleasant sensations. Oops, now I've lost pure intention. Now I'm desiring something, I'm grasping something, I'm holding on to something. So this powerful, sweet stuff becomes just another thing to grasp, another thing to cling to. And we have to not, that's a thing you have to really watch for as these things start to arrive more and more in your practice. It's like, I want that again. And that doesn't work. I also want to mention in what Joseph said, he said something about how these steps along the way sort of help us overcome the hindrances. And there's actually a commentary I came across that noted which of the different hindrances each of these steps sort of helped eliminate. I just thought I wanted to mention that. So aiming tends to sort of tune down sloth and torpor. You know, that sense of, oh, I'm just going to sit here and drift. Well, now you're not aiming at anything. You just started drifting. And once you start consciously choosing to aim to see the beginning of every breath or see the beginning of any particular sensation you're about to note and then sustain on that sensation, but the aiming does away with the sloth and torpor. It's like focus. The mental focus sort of takes the sloth and torpor and washes it out of the system in a sense. It sort of wakes you up from sloth and torpor. And vichara, sustaining, interestingly enough, it's often considered an antidote to doubt. Because you begin to see, as you start to sustain on an object, you start to really see things as they really are. Start to see how everything is just, because in the process of sustaining, you see things change. Everything's constantly changing all the time. There's no stability, there's no solidity at all. And also that things just keep disappearing. You sustain on it and then it's gone. Because you stayed on it long enough to see it disappear, literally. Another translations of vichara by sustaining, by the way, might be rubbing against. It's like you're getting to get close to something, to sustain something, you have to get really close to it. But it's not like close to it and leaning on it and pushing on it. It's more just sort of rubbing against it. Not like a cat rubs against your legs sometimes. They're sustaining contact with you in that way. And that's sort of rubbing against, or just being close to. You're getting closer to something when you sustain. And then pithi is an antidote to aversion. When these more pleasant, interesting manifestations start to arise, your aversion just goes, oh, I'm not averse to this. You know, and being careful, of course, not to get too addicted to it, but it's not like it's not only sort of like, oh, I that's fine. Okay, so that's pithi. Next comes sukha. Sukha is often translated as happiness or pleasure. But This isn't, usually when we think, especially of pleasure, we think of pleasure arising out of obtaining things, out of physical contact. And this has this happiness that arises at this level of concentration has nothing to do with getting anything. It's purely a mental state that's joyful. It's that pithy energy, that sort of arousing energetic energy of pithy, has now calmed. It's smoothed out. It isn't so compelling anymore. This is an antidote to restlessness. Pithy can have this sort of restless, jerky sort of energy. Whereas by the time when sukha arises, when the concentration is deepened to this level, now it's like there's a more of just this soft, calm, still sweetness. It is joyful, it is happiness, it is pleasure, but not from getting anything. It's just from the mind in this state, this calm, still state, has a certain flavor to it that is very pleasurable. Once again, being careful not to get addicted to this one either. It's subtler. And the danger there is like, oh no, I finally got to where I want to go. Just one more step. Actually, I want to read something else from Joseph Goldstein here. And he's talking about this sense of joy that arises at this level. Receiving joy is another way to say enjoyment, and samadhi is an act of refined enjoyment. And that's a nice line, way to think of it. Refined enjoyment. It's based in skillfulness. It is the careful collecting of oneself into the joy of the present moment. Joyfulness means there's no fear, no tension, no ought to. That's an interesting one. No ought to. Like it isn't like, oh, I should be doing this now. I should be paying more attention. I should be, I should be, I should be. How often are we caught there in our practice? So there's no should be, no ought to. There's just what's happening right now. There isn't anything we have to do about it. It's just this. It's just this. Okay. Then we come to the last of the five. It's called Ekagata. Ekka means one in Pali. You see Ekka in the front of a lot of words. It's also the same in Sanskrit, by the way. Now, Ekagata, one-pointedness, non-distraction. It's that space where the mind is concentrated and it just doesn't get distracted at all. It's just purely concentrated. And it isn't that things aren't arising at the sense doors. It isn't that stuff isn't happening at the bodily level or at the mental level. It's just that you don't get distracted by them anymore. They don't hook you. You notice that that image that I like, that we're floating on this stream like a fish, and things keep getting dropped into the stream like little bits of bait on hooks. And if we just watch them as we go by, or as they go by, we don't get distracted by them, we don't get hooked by them, fine. But what happens, of course, is we go, ooh, there's a juicy one. We bite down on it, and then there's the hook, and there we are flopping around again before we know it. We're caught by that thought. Now we're being distracted by that thing, whatever it is, and the story about it, and oh, my knee is going to be sore for the rest of this retreat, and oh, no, and you know, blah, 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 blah. The mind gets hooked by these things. And once you're at this point of ekagata, one-pointedness, that just isn't happening anymore. And it has, once again, a very distinct mental sensation, a mental flavor. When you're in this deeply concentrated, you'll know. And it might just be for like 5 seconds, by the way. Of course, this is like 5 seconds is a long time sometimes to be this concentrated. And then, you know, something, you do get distracted. And then, you know, you flop around for a while. Maybe a while is like 3 seconds, or maybe it's 5 minutes. But then if you're still, this ekagata will come back. It's something that comes over, and it becomes more and more sort of the default mode. Another word for this might be equanimity. That's a ekagata, one point in this is a way to say that you've reached a mental state of equanimity. They're not synonyms, but they're very tightly related. They're like a couple of close cousins. They're tight, but they're not exactly the same. Another word sometimes used is completeness. In ekagata, everything is complete. There's no need for anything else. That's the mental space that you're in when you're in this one-pointed state. So of course, this, by the way, is thought of as an antidote to craving. When you're in ekagata, you don't feel like you need anything else. There's no craving anymore. That distraction of wanting something is gone. So at this point, all of the kalesas have disappeared. All of the traditional distractions are all sort of, the antidotes are all in action. Because these stages I've been talking about are cumulative. One leads to the next, but just because, you know, now you're an ekagata, that doesn't mean you're still not aiming and sustaining. So all five of these are functioning together in some way, that they just, it just, the flow of concentration is continuous. And I want to point out, I want to remind you, I suppose, that really when we're talking about concentration in this way, it could be either that one-pointed concentration of having one particular object of concentration, like the breath or a mantra or a visualization. There's lots of different ways of doing it. Or it could be that moment-to-moment concentration, you know, moment-to-moment, like this is what's arisen, I note that. 3 seconds later, now this is what's most predominant, and I note that. That noting process, that is, can be extremely concentrated. You can be in ekagata and be noting. But now you're just noting without ever being pulled out into grabbing onto anything, because craving is gone. Restlessness is gone. There's nothing, you're complete. That's why I like the translation, completeness. There's nothing, there's no need, you know, feel no need for anything else. So that's the five factors of concentration: aiming, sustaining, intense interest, happiness, and one-pointedness. And it's a cumulative process. And in any one meditative sitting or walking practice or just hanging out in the world sometimes even, these can all arise. You know, it's just a matter of practice. These are things, as Joseph said, this isn't something that happens instantaneously. This takes practice. And it isn't like, you know, this shaking feeling, well, you should be doing this. This is just the natural process. In some sense, this is the natural result of practicing over longer periods of time. Both longer periods in like on a retreat sense, or just longer periods of time in, oh, I've been practicing for a long time in my life now on a regular basis every day, and these things start to arise. Now I'm going to wave a yellow warning flag here now. This is something I thought was very interesting. This is, we talked about the kalesas are gone. The kalesas are sometimes called the gross impurities. Right? Gross in the large sense, as opposed to the gross sense. Also sometimes they're all that too, I suppose. But there are also things called subtle impurities. And these are things that Joseph, in this particular section of this book, warns against. Then I think it's important that I share these, as I think about the yellow warning flags are being waved here. So it's interesting to reflect on what impurities mean in terms of our practice. Some aspects of the word are obvious, like wrong actions of body and speech, and unwholesome thoughts of greed, ill will, and cruelty. But the Buddha also spoke of subtler impurities, such as being lost in worldly thoughts of family and friends, of reputation, of work. As lay people living in the world, we do need to think about these things sometimes. But very often, we're simply lost in a kind of unnoticed reverie about them, drifting along in habits of thought that may not be particularly unwholesome, but may be inappropriate or unnecessary for the task at hand. Are they necessary? Probably not. This is a big one for me, this particular impurity. I can't tell you the number of times I'll be sitting and I have a job coming up doing, you know, fixing someone's fence or something. And what am I doing? And a lot of us probably work and have jobs, right? And we get caught up in figuring something out, how I'm going to do it. Well, I got to make sure I get the right kind of cement and blah, blah. Oh, should I get 8-foot posts or only 6-foot posts? You know, the mind just goes off. And this isn't like bad, but it's not like, have you ever actually at the end of a sitting period gone, oh boy, I'm really glad I figured that all out. No, it's like, oh, I've thought about that 7 times and I only knew what I was going to do anyway, right? But we get caught in that inappropriate and unnecessary thoughts. And then he goes on. And an even subtler level of impurity is when we're lost in Dharma thoughts about our practice and different meditative states. These thoughts are so seductive precisely because they are about the Dhamma. And as with worldly thoughts, there are times when conscious, mindful Dhamma reflection can be a big help on the path. But when we are simply lost in Dhamma reveries or in judgments about our practice, underline that 3 times, or in judgments about our practice, they are not particularly helpful. This is another place we go. We're like, oh, I'm thinking about the Dhamma, so this is okay. And this is another thing. It's quite easy to get caught in these places. These are subtle. That they don't seem, oh, like I'm thinking about the Dhamma. How could that be bad? But they're just, now I've just got distracted again. My mind has wandered off into blah, blah, blah land about how my practice is going and what about this and what about that. You know, that person next to me seems to be meditating much more seriously than I am. And, you know, that's a retreat one. But it's like, it happens all the time. I'll give you one little example. This is a Joseph Goldstein story that I quite love. He was talking about one of his very first long retreats where there was just a big dormitory room. And in this dormitory room, there were like partitions that didn't even go all the way up to the ceiling, and there was no door. So like it just had a space for your bed and a little table and a little lamp. And then there's the next guy and the next guy and the next guy. There's this big couple of rows of things like this. And Joseph, being the type A personality that he is, or was anyway, probably still is, he was like, I'm going to be the last one to stop practicing tonight. He was like convinced that he was going to be the last one, right? And so he'd sit and he'd practice and he'd study and he'd sit some more and practice some more. But there's way down the end of the row, there's this other guy whose light was always still on. And finally, Joseph would be exhausted and he'd fall asleep. But this went on night after night after night, where he never quite stay up as late as that other guy. He was always second best. And this is like he was really judging himself about this. Like, that guy should, how can that guy do better than me? And it turns out, of course, he talks to the guy at the end of the retreat and he says, oh no, I just like to sleep with my light on. But he'd gone through this whole process for the whole retreat about judging himself for not being diligent enough, when actually he was being incredibly diligent, knowing Joseph. But, okay. So, I have a little a bullet on my notes here. It says, so why is this all so important? Why have I spent 2 days now talking about concentration and these five steps? And basically, it comes down to this. When the mind is concentrated, when the mind is concentrated and focused and still in that way, it's much more likely that we'll have moments of very clear insight where we're seeing things extremely clearly, and insights into, you know, the nature of the true nature of everything, that everything is impermanent, that everything is constantly changing, that there's no self. That's when these moments of enlightenment, of deep enlightenment, of insight arise, or they're more likely to arise, because we've got the mind in this non-distracted state, just totally paying attention to what's arising right now. It's like we've now created the causes and conditions, as us Buddhists say, so that these moments of insight and enlightenment can actually arise. So that's why it's so important, in a sense. In general, concentration and mindfulness are like two sides of a coin. You know, we can't have just concentration and mindfulness. You know, we can't just practice mindfulness but not ever be concentrated. But if we just practice concentration and don't have the mindfulness aspect of it, then it just becomes this addictive way of getting into this calm, clear, still state. And so what? We become very skillful at shutting out the world for periods of time, which is what the Buddha discovered when he initially left home. And the first thing he did is he went to two different great concentration teachers, And he both taught him to concentrate, and he got to these very deep levels of concentration. But he said eventually he realized, so what? I'm still, as long when I was in these deep states of concentration, I didn't suffer. I was, you know, the kilesas were gone. I was just in this deep, pure, calm, still spaces. But then I had to wake up and live in the world. I couldn't stay in that deep, concentrated state of samadhi all the time. It wasn't physically possible or mentally possible. I had to eat, I had to sleep, I had to, you know, go to the toilet like everybody else. I had to go for a walk so my body didn't fall apart. I couldn't stay there all the time. And so it's that balance of concentration makes mindfulness work better. Mindfulness sort of starts to arise and we start to see things more clearly, and that encourages us to concentrate more. Because the clearer scene we see is based on the concentration. Two sides of the coin. We need both. Somehow the balance of both. Also, I'm only going to touch on this. Concentration practice leads to other states of mind, in a sense. I suppose they're mental states, called the jhanas. And the jhanas are these very deep states of concentration that are useful, because in those states we really do start to, you know, lose sense of physicalness, lose sense of me being separate from everything else. You start to, as you go deeper into the jhana states, you get clearer and clearer insight through sensation, partly, of everything that's going on. You're not separate from it anymore. The other thing with the jhana states is they're extremely energetic. So when you go into the jhana states and you sort of hang out there, you are literally like charging up your battery. And you can come out of jhana states and then your mind is like crystal clear, because you've been energized by the jhanas themselves. This is all I'm going to say about this. This is something that isn't talked about a lot. Joseph certainly talks about them in the book, but to actually teach how to go there is something that's only ever done on an individual basis. It's never taught in this sort of way. All the teaching I got on it was one-on-one with my teacher when it was clear that I was ready to sort of understand what was going on. But that came from me practicing the five factors of concentration. They lead directly to the jhana states. Jhana states also typically only arrive in longer, more concentrated periods of meditation, like on retreat. They tend to not arise in day-to-day practice. You need that sort of sustained several days, many days, continuous practice to get concentrated enough that the jhana states will arise at all. So, but these deep states of concentration, both the jhanas and just like being in ekagata, the other thing that's interesting is that, and you've heard me say this before, so it's not going to be new and surprising. At the point where you're that sort of concentrated, where concentration is deepened, you start to pay less and less attention to the details of what's arising, and more to the underlying pattern of what's going on. Like you start to pay more attention to the impermanence of everything, because you're actually experiencing things arise, be there, and they're gone. And then something else, and then something else. You actually start to, impermanence is no longer this sort of philosophical mental concept. It's an experience. The impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self start to be things that you actually experience, because the details of what's going on, quite literally, you lose interest in them. I think that's the only way, the best way to say it. You just go, "Eh, who cares about all that stuff that's floating through my brain? It isn't important. It's just stuff." That's the way I felt at times when I've been deeply concentrated. The details of what's arising, you know, the actual stories and the actual stuff that's going on is like, it's more just like, oh, there's another thing. Yep, there's another thing. It's just more into the process, the underlying structure of how the mind actually operates is what becomes apparent when you're concentrated. This is what leads to insight and enlightenment. So it seems relatively important in that sense too. And I want to end by saying, don't get discouraged. Like, I've made this sound like some, oh, well, only those people who, you know, go on long retreats and practice long periods of time, blah, blah. All of us can practice these, you know, vitaka and vichara, the first two steps. And I guarantee you that if you do, pitti will arise. You'll start to have those pitti experiences. So you're going to start to tune into this stuff no matter what you do, even in your daily practice. As long as you actually consciously, it's like it's a choice. I'm going to actually practice aiming and sustaining. This is like part of my practice. And let's see what happens. And then the others will naturally arise the more you practice aiming and sustaining. So this is for everyone. And it just leads to, there's like stages, you know. More and more and more interesting things. And sometimes quite difficult things, I'll be honest with you as well, happen when, as you get more concentrated. Okay, so that's, I think, all I have to say. So let's just dedicate the merit of the practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.